Hello and welcome to the Scotland Outdoors podcast, brought to you by those fine upstanding folk at the BBC. It's Saturday the 20th of February. I'm Mark Stephen, and today we're going to be bringing you the second of our two special podcasts from Norway. Now, if you'd like more information about any of our podcasts, or indeed the programme itself, then please visit our website at bbc.co.uk/Radio Scotland. As we've reported previously on Out of Doors, the loss of sheep to large carnivores is something of a serious problem in Norway, so much so that sheep farmers in some areas are leaving the industry in droves. Asbjørn Helland is regional leader of the Farmers Union in Nord-Trøndelag, and he told us which animals are taking sheep near him.
The predators are bears, first of all in this area, but we also have wolves, and we have wolverines, and we have lynxes and eagles.
So how do these predators affect the farmers? Is it they're going for lambs? Are they tackling sheep? What's the problem?
Mostly the problem here is bears. They are taking the sheep and also lambs, of course. Also the reindeers.
I've never been to this area before. And you drive up on very good roads, and it is rolling farmland. I mean, yes, it goes down towards the water, towards the fjords and things, but, you know, it's pretty. It's obviously fertile land. The fact that you're having to deal with bears and wolves and wolverines and eagles, you know, and lynx just doesn't seem to fit. I mean, is it a big problem?
Yes, it's a big problem for the people who are living not very central, but nearby mountains. You know, we have smallholders who have very little land on their farm, so they have to go to the mountains on pasture with the sheep.
The bears, how do they attack and how many sheep would they take?
They can attack and take a lot of sheep, but you know, the wolves are more dangerous about because they are many hunting together. The bears, mostly the young female bears, are the problem because they are going over a big district and take a sheep here and a sheep there. And we have problem because the lambs will leave her mother, and maybe the mother are leaving the lambs and so on because they are so afraid.
Are you allowed to defend your flocks? I mean, are you allowed to shoot the bears, the wolves, whatever it is?
Oh, no. Oh, no. We have international agreements, and we also have agreements with government to have so much bear in this area, with so much wolverines and so much lynxes and also eagles. So we can shoot if we see one.
Does the farmer get compensation?
Yes.
Does he get paid?
Yes, but you have to prove it. And it's not not always easy to prove it, because the mountains are big.
And are these predators, were they reintroduced? Have the Norwegian farmers always lived with wolverine and bear and wolves?
Oh, no. It was not at all so much of that kind 30 years ago. They're coming in more and more. It is decided how much bear we shall have, how much wolverines, how much lynxes, and so on.
You're talking to farmers all the time. Would farmers like to see some of these animals, or do they just want rid of them all?
Now, the farmers does understand that we have an international agreement that we have to care of those animals, but some areas are for the sheep and some areas are for the bears. But the bears doesn't know the...
They don't recognise that line on the map.
That line on the map, that's right.
Wolves can't read maps, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, as a farmer, how does that make farmers feel? Because I'm assuming that Norwegian farmers are exactly the same as Scottish farmers. You become attached to your animals. On an emotional level, they matter to you.
If they are attached, the farmers,
yes.
Then you are allowed to shoot, of course. Self-defence, yeah.
People talk about wolves or bears maybe taking one lamb or one sheep. Have you got an example of how it's impacted on farming communities?
We have an example here in the Nord-Trøndelag, in the middle part of Norway, that is called Lierne. That's high in the mountains. There was 70 sheep farmers in 1980. Now it's two or three left.
Yeah. Just because of predators?
Yes, because of predators.
You know, the farmers take one position, the environmentalists are maybe taking another position. How do the general public feel? Where do their sympathies lie? Do the sympathies lie with the farmers or do the sympathies lie with the bears and the wolves and the wolverines?
I think here in the middle part of Norway, here in Nord-Trøndelag, we have sympathy with the farmers from the people, but not in Oslo.
In Scotland, we're having the debate about reintroducing wolves, possibly reintroducing lynx. Mm-hmm. What would you say to people in Scotland about that happening? Is that a good thing, or is that something that maybe you think is not quite so good?
Think twice.
Norwegian farmer Asbjørn Helland there. Obviously, this has got big implications for anything that we might choose to do here in Scotland.
I was just sitting, we were both sitting there having a cup of tea, and I was just, my jaw was dropping when the numbers that he was talking about. Because here we talk about, you know, potentially a lynx maybe taking one or two. When you're up at hundreds and potentially thousands, it's massive. And I don't know about you, but it really made me think, actually, I've been slightly in favour, perhaps, of discussing the concept of things like lynx. Wow, this is actually much bigger.
Thinking of the reality, yeah.
Well, yeah, this is much bigger. And if you're a farmer sitting listening to that, you're going to be, wow, we need to discuss this big time before we have that kind of, it's almost environmental guilt trip of we need to fix things. But you also need to think about it carefully before you start doing something major like that.
Lynx, wolves, bears, you name it.
Wolverines.
Wolverines could all be coming down the pike, you never know. One of the things that jumped out at us, I mean really jumped out at us in Norway, is how busy their countryside is. It's peppered with family farms, really thriving communities. Now, an aspect of the national psyche which contributes to this landscape is a desire to live on the land, build life from that basis. And that's what led one group of farmers' wives in Nord-Trøndelag to commit to working at home and joining together to form a sort of collective brand. Claire White heard more about their so-called golden detour from agricultural director of the county, Kirsten Vierdal.
I'm a lady. I'm almost 59 years old. I have been a farmer earlier. I have also been president in Norwegian Farmers Union. And I can also tell you that I was the very first lady in the world that chaired the Farmers Union's organization. But that's some years ago.
We are not meeting you in your natural place. No. We meet you in an office, in a stat house right on the outskirts of Steinkjer. So tell me about what happens back home on the farm.
My husband and I, we had the farm from 1978. We had, as many people had at that time, about 20 dairy calves and some pigs. In 2007, my youngest son bought the farm from us. Now we live at the farm. But since he bought the farm and together with his wife, they have three times as many dairy cows as we had. They have a milking robot. He is also trying to establish meat cattle. And he has also established a small farming hotel with 9 double rooms where we serve delicious food from ourselves and from the neighbourhood.
So is this change in your son's farming practice a little example of how farming is changing in Norway?
Farms produce much more than they did earlier, twice and three times as much. And some also make, for example, cheese at the farm. Some have also travelling products at the farm. But that's not that common. And of course, also, a lot of farmers stop farming, go out to other type of work, and the neighbours are renting their land and produce on that.
You described yourself as very much as a female farmer. You're obviously proud of that. What have you done specifically as women in your countryside in Norway?
I think it's very essential that women on farms find their own way to do it. And for example, the Golden Detour, it is women on the farms that said, now I want to make a working place for me at that farm. And that makes new initiatives. When that farm couple does that together, I think that gives very often a good result.
What is the Golden Detour?
It's some farms, but it's also some other activities. They have built a brand, our small area at Innreden. We brand that area the Golden Detour. It's a very, very beautiful landscape out there. And we have local food, we have local beer. And you can go from farm to farm buying handicraft, buying cheese, and everything.
And how do people transport themselves around that route?
Of course, very often by car, but now we have also made some routes for biking.
So how did the Golden Tea Tour come about?
It was some farms that wanted to make new products, not only the volume production, but cheese maker, and it was another one making special things with the meats. And then they started to talk together. The brilliant person said that we might have a name on that, and that the name was the Golden Tea Tour. And then they started to brand this. And that was back in 1997, I think.
And so it was the women of these farms that brought this about?
Yes, you can go from farm to farm. It is the women that has made the products. Be sure about that.
So destination marketing works certainly in some parts of Scotland. What can the Norwegian experience tell us about that?
I think each farmer with his and her products, they will be too small for communicating in a big market. And that's much better when a lot of them goes together.
And do you think this has come about because of the way farming already works in Norway? The fact that you share machinery, that you cooperate at municipality levels a great deal, does this inspire the kind of enterprise that wouldn't otherwise happen?
Yes, probably you're right. And also because farmers in Norway, a lot of them have a higher education, and they want to create their own interesting place to work. And also because of the structural changing in the volume production. When that started, farmers started to look at, is it other things we can do also, where we use our big houses, where we can tell about the life as farmers, tell about how it is to produce food, and everything like that. So I think it grows up like that.
And what difference is this making to the lives of the women involved?
I think one period in 70s and 80s, it was very common that ladies at farms, they started to take works outside the farm, as teachers, for example, or other things. But this make it possible to go back and create their own working place at the farm. And I think that makes it more interesting to be farmers when you have those type of farming in a big environment, I think so. And I think very often women, they might think different about farming than men does. So that makes also, I think the culture, the farm culture, will be better when women take part in developing the countryside like that.
Agricultural Director of Nord-Trøndelag, Kirsten Jado there, and there are photos of today's contributors, or some of today's contributors, on our Facebook page. If you've any suggestions for how Scotland's rural communities might brand themselves better, we would like to hear them.
What a great idea, though. I mean, because we, as you go around the country, you get gems or an inkling of something like that. A lot of people doing little things, but the idea of getting it all together in one group is just brilliant. I love it. If you certainly got any comments, you can email In the Car Park, at outdoors@bbc.co.uk. You can text 80295 and tweet at BBC Out of Doors. A lot of people say, do you do it in the car park? Yes,
we do.
We're dodging the traffic.
Sometimes we have to dodge the cars as they come in. There's no option. Now, our Norway visit inspired countless new thoughts about how country life could look here in Scotland. A lot of this emanates from a different education system. Whilst we were on our travels, we stopped by Mer Agricultural College to see how rural skills are taught early in life in Norway. Ewan asked head teacher, Rolf Vensbach, about the syllabus for 16 to 19-year-olds.
I think that a school like this have to be special in the future. So not being a traditional school, but also do something special. And the society will see that we do special things that you can see in collection with agriculture. So I think it's very important.
So you're taking children at 16 that would normally be in a secondary school, certainly in Scotland, and are they concentrating solely on agriculture, or is agriculture just a big part of their ordinary education?
Here in this school, it's because we are a special school, yes. So we have agriculture, and we have landscape, and we have forestry here, yes, and they can read more about horse education, yes, here. And then they can go to university after they have.
So they're still doing maths and English and Norwegian?
And chemistry and physics, yes. Students, maybe they are 60% of the time in the classroom, and then they are 40% out in the practical areas. So many of our students are very practical. They like to work with their hands.
So are they from farming families originally, or are these potentially the farmers of the future who haven't come from a farming background?
I think mostly all of our students come from farm, but not all of them. Some come from the cities and want to work with machines and work with animals and so on. But they have interest in for the green subjects. Yes.
How important is it for somebody to be qualified in farming, to actually get involved in farming in Norway? Do they have to be qualified to own a farm, perhaps?
Yes, I think in the future it's very important to be qualified, because farmers are going bigger. They have to compete with international products. I think in the future they have to get more competence and have special competence in what they are going to produce.
It's all very well for you to turn out highly qualified students. How easy is it for them to get a farm if they don't have a family farm to go to?
It's not easy to get a farm because there are special rules. So it's not easy to get a farm and must have a lot of money.
So presumably it's quite a specialist job being a farmer in Norway with, you know, a relatively small amount of land to get a healthy income. You have to be pretty smart.
Yes, you have to be smart, you must do the right things. And now it's you have to get bigger farms to have a wage that you can have a good living for them. Yes.
But the farmers open to change. You're coming out with all these students and they're full of great ideas that they've learned here, new techniques. You know, we need to try that. Are farmers open to new technology, new techniques,
yes,
new ideas?
Yes, they are very innovative. If you see the production have been bigger in each farm, you can see that they have innovated very much, take much technique, robots, big tractors and so on. So it's very much technical equipment that we are using.
How difficult was it to attract students? Because you would have thought there'd been big money in oil and banking and in the cities rather than in agriculture.
Yes. We compete about the young people because, as you said, the oil have been very good, but the oil is not as good as it has been. So I think that the young people now look more to green values. They want to study green subjects. And I think it will be a positive for us in the future that agriculture and forest will be very important.
My name is Johannes Wall.
Why do you want to come to this school rather than a normal school?
Because I like the practical work. I like to learn practical things. Although I also like to study mathematics and chemistry and physics. So it was a very nice combination.
So are you from a farming family?
Yes, I'm from a pig farm, and we have also grains.
So do you want to go back to pig farming, or do you want to go to university and then maybe come back to farming?
First of all, university, then maybe back to farming, because the future in Norwegian farming is quite insecure, so it can be a good thing to have something in backup.
What would you like to do? Would you like to go into farming if it was an option?
Yes, I would very much like to go into farming.
Is it difficult for many young people? You know, you could possibly go into oil or banking or whatever. How attractive is agriculture or farming for young people?
If you have a farming background, farming is attractive because then you are used to the life and you are used to work hard from the start off.
Is it a good life?
Yes, it's a very good life with a lot of freedom, a lot of work too.
You touched on it there, farming, an uncertain future. What do you think the problems are facing farming in Norway in the future?
The main problem, I think, is economics. Food from abroad are getting cheaper than the Norwegian farming needs to catch up.
What about when you leave university and you come back with all these great ideas and new techniques? And do you think your family will be receptive to that?
Yes, I think so. My family will be very receptive.
So you're quite excited about the future then?
Yes, I am.
Johannes Vaughan and Rolf Vensbach there. And whilst we were at Mera Agricultural College, I actually found myself a forester to ask about the plantation patterns I'd clocked from the car. Gunnar Botsvik is a forester teacher and advisor.
This is a place really history for Norway, because in this place, the old kings, the holy king Olav, was baptized Norway to be a Christian. Before that, the Vikings, they have the power here. Today, this place is an agriculture school. And now we are building a cowhouse.
Now, this is fascinating to me because it's being built out of mass timber. If we were doing this in the northeast of Scotland, we would use steel. Mm. Why does it make sense to use timber here?
It's about the environment. We must go in the front for showing how you can use timber.
Okay.
Instead of steel or beton.
Okay.
And you see, it will come to be a very nice house. We have some trouble here when we want to build this. Because you have the church.
It's an absolutely beautiful church, and you can see it from miles around from the main road. Yes.
And this is from the 13th century.
Ah, right. Okay.
And they told us that we couldn't build this cow house. It come too near. And then I said to them, if this is a problem, we can move the church.
And they changed their minds.
So you see, it's massive.
Right now it's got very little in the way of walls. It's got nothing in the way of roof. We're looking at this pale, pale pine. When I say massive timber, the beams themselves would be 150 millimetres thick, but maybe 600 millimetres, you know, in depth. And it's really, really lots and lots of wood here.
So, you see, the CO2 will be here for many, many years.
Yeah.
And Norway have a lot of wood.
Yeah.
And we must use it.
Is there a national policy, a national forestry policy in Norway?
Yes, we have. It's planned for all the Norway. We have taxed all the wood in Norway, and we are cutting the trees, we are replanted. You have 1 year, and then you must replant.
Is Norway self-sufficient in timber? Do you have enough for your needs?
Yes, and we have more than that. So Norway export a lot of timber to England.
The fact that the timber has never been devalued, you know, it's regarded as something valuable, does that affect how the politicians deal with it?
Oh, yes, yes, of course, of course. This is a big resource for us. Now we have the oil and the gas, but before that, the trees was very important for Norway as an export article.
Because you have this long tradition of using timber in this country, I wonder if it's always done a traditional way, or do the builders and architects, are they innovating, are they doing things in new ways?
They are doing things in new ways. We're building houses, we're building bridge, as you see down here.
So effectively what you're doing is you're taking the timber and laminating it. You're making it much thicker into beams.
And it don't burn. Yeah. It's stronger than steel.
Stronger than steel?
Yes, it's stronger than steel, they say.
The fact there is a tradition of using forestry in Norway, presumably it's not just you have a national forestry policy, as you were saying, but it must inform Norwegian builders, it must inform Norwegian architects. They are used to working in their own timber.
Yes, they are. And the government say we must build as much as we can using wood.
Who actually owns the trees? Who owns the forestry?
About 61% is owned by the private. The state owns about 30%, and the rest is companies.
What's the predominant tree?
It's pine.
Pine?
Yeah, and that's most used in the buildings.
Is it quite slow growing here?
From your planting the trees, it go between 70 100 years. And then you have tight fibers.
Yes.
And it can stand for the wind and for the rain and for the cold and for war.
So now, well, when this is finished, you're going to have the beautiful 13th century church at the top of the hill there. It's up against a blue sky at the moment. It's lovely. And a new cathedral here for cows.
Yes. This is perfect for us as a school, but also for the cows. And that's very important.
Yeah. Norwegian forestry consultant Gunnar Botsvig there. Interesting the approach they actually take to it. You know, for us, forestry is something that other people do, you know, whereas it's seen almost as part and parcel of normal life across there. We were only in Norway for about, 5 days, and we did a tremendous amount in that time. And the one area we managed to sort of fail in, if you want to put it that way, was to visit a farm that had its own hydroelectricity supply. Renewables are a really big deal in Norway. They've underpinned the country's rural development in ways that potentially could be applicable to Scotland. Duna Hedegaard of Mere Agricultural College, explain more to Ewan.
The renewables have always been very important in Norway. We've been big users of firewood, of course. In growing bioeconomy, it will be even more important. So for us, the forestry and the forest products will be most important.
And hydro as well.
Hydro is, of course, the big issue in Norway. We produce almost all of our electricity from hydropower, and we export a lot of it.
So is that big, massive hydroelectric stations or lots of small hydro operations?
Mostly it's produced in the bigger plants, but the smaller plants are growing in numbers, yeah. But the big figures come from the bigger plants, yeah.
So is that integrating with farming as well, or are they completely separate?
In newer days, the smaller plants are integrated, but often it's special companies running them where the farmers are owners as well.
So what about the bio aspects of renewables? So what kind of things are you doing?
In the local production, it will be most wood chips that you take the forest and what you not can sell to the sawmill and so on. You chop it up in chips and you put it into a quite small or bigger stoves and make heat to the farm or to the house or to the local community or whatever. Some is also produced into pellet, but that's more residuals from the forest industry. That is dry material, you just squeeze it together to pellet. And so we also have a starting production of biogas. And that's mostly from residuals from agriculture, from fish industry.
So what's the situation here? Because we're in a whole series of massive greenhouses. We've got big, huge trays of small tomato plants in front of me. It's minus 16 degrees outside. How are you heating this?
This is a very special project going on here. The important thing here is to be very efficient about the energy use. In a greenhouse, they need the light, and that produces some heat. Together with that, you will normally have to heat with the natural gas or whatever, electricity. And here, we try to drop that. We have started a project where some scientists from Trondheim comes here, and they have made a system where they collect the heat in the days with a lot of sun. When it's too hot, we open ceiling area and let too much heat out so the plants will not be too hot. When we collect the heat, we can stop opening the ceiling, keep the warm in here, collect it, put it down in the ground. Then we have a day system for the collection. Under here, a big water tank that we can store the heat and take it up in the night. And in year term, we can take it from here and down in big, deep boreholes out here and store it for the winter time.
So you've got a big, massive battery down there,
yeah,
in the form of water.
Yeah. We would think that it will disappear down in the ground, but actually it keeps around the boreholes.
And you're also working with pigs as well.
The pigs will grow better if they have a heating in the floor. And now the whole school here, all the buildings you see around here, is going to be connected with this system. It's been built out even bigger than it is now. So we turn it into heat in the winter time. In all the buildings here.
So, I mean, how are you getting the heat from the pigs? How's that working? Is that the pig manure?
We use the heat here actually to warm the pigs
right
today. But we have also plans, but that is only plans, to build a biogas production plant down at the new barn we are building. And then we can use that for the tractors or for heating.
So how good are the tomatoes that you grow?
They are very, very good. And actually with the new system, we have reduced the energy use here by 80%.
Wow.
And we also, together with that, increased the tomato production by 40%. But that is partly because of new growing methods as well.
So is that the potential? You know, it's obviously trials here. Can that be rolled out across Norway?
Of course. The scientists here, they have made their own company because they see a big potential here, not in greenhouses, of course there as well, but in normal houses. Maybe the future will be that we build like greenhouses, more glass in the houses, collect the heat, store it for the winter, and pick it back in winter time. So they look for it for bigger houses in the cities and wherever.
It's quite exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very exciting. But today, this saved energy is very expensive. It's testing. And
but it is working. It's just a matter of cost.
Yeah, very, very efficient it is, but it's expensive to build today. But it will be cheaper when they start mass production, of course.
Duna Hedegaard of Mera Agricultural College there. You're listening to the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which today is a special episode made up of the second of our two programmes on Norway. Now, you can contact us anytime on outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, or if you prefer, then visit our Facebook page. Just look for Out of Doors, where you can also check out some photos and videos from our trip and get in touch. We're quite keen to find out, too, where in the world you are listening to this. It's always a matter of some curiosity to us, and get a wee bit of a buzz off it sometimes. Everyone we spoke to in Norway explained the lifelong connection folk there have with the countryside, even when they move around for work. Now, that connection to the land is very often expressed in a desire to take walks, pretty regularly, often to simple wooden chalets known as hytter. I'd heard about them, I'd never actually been to one, so I thought I'd go and have a shifty. So I teamed up with tour guide Nina Pettersson in Stjenker, for an icy hike in a type of footwear that, frankly, was brand new to me.
I would say call it the mini crampons, maybe?
Mini crampons,
yes.
Right, okay. Basically, it's almost like a rubber thing with chains and yeah. Like little fangs that fit on your feet.
So, should I help you?
Yeah, please, if you wouldn't mind. Yeah. Where does that go?
It's like...
I've got big feet, so that's
yeah,
not
enough. Yeah, you have. I think it's okay. We'll try.
Yeah. That's not bad.
No?
When that came out, I thought, there's no way that's going over that boot. But it has.
Yeah.
I can feel that's my good. Toes curling up, but yeah. Right, and other foot.
It's like helping children.
You're not the first person on this programme to have made that comment. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm standing now facing the car with my heel up behind me, a bit like a horse, being shod.
Yeah, it's like
you can be the blacksmith. Ow! Love it.
You can run like a horse.
Ta-da! If only. Actually, that feels fantastic.
Yeah?
Yeah. I like that.
Yeah.
That's great. Where are we going to go today?
We're going to Svartsjönna, in English, Black Lake.
Uh-huh.
And that's an area here in Stensjö that a lot of people are walking in here.
Uh-huh.
In summertime on the foot and in wintertime on skis.
Yeah, this is an unusual winter because there's not a lot of snow.
No. You can see now it's a lot of ice.
Yeah.
So we are not going to ski today.
Uh-huh.
And Elsa, she's one of the people here, voluntary people, that
okay.
has built up the whole area. And a lot of children are using it every year. Every week we have a lot of families and a lot of children. The schools are using it.
Hmm? Oh, well, we'll get started.
Yeah.
When did the Norwegians become such an outdoor people? Historically, was there a point where suddenly people thought, actually, I want to go outdoors?
After the union with Sweden and Denmark, and the Norwegians were no longer Vikings,
okay.
we needed to make a new identity. What is a Norwegian? And you know, we have this special nature with fjords and glaciers, mountains, wide nature, forests, and so on, and a lot of scientists, writers, artists, explorers. They went around in Norway and tell people about the beauty and the greatness. And but, you know, the farmers, they did not go on the glacier or on the top of a mountain because they lived in it. And
yeah.
And it was only the...
There were no sheep up there anyway.
No,
what was the point?
Yeah, exactly.
I can't get over how much this actually reminds me of Scotland. I mean, this entire area.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it's very much reminiscent of the Highlands.
Okay.
We're walking through a sort of pine trees at the moment on a track. You can hear how frozen the track is. It's practically sheet ice. It's about minus 10. Really fresh on any exposed skin.
Earlier, we had much more people hiking in the mountains in holidays and so. But we see now also that... You know, the daily trip outside is important for people. So we have a lot of roads
uh-huh.
close to the cities.
Yeah.
So the people that live in the cities after work can have a trip outside in the forest.
So this is the hut up here.
Yes, here is the Svartsjönna and the lake is down there. We have canoes and outdoor equipment for making fire and so on.
Yeah, I like this, the wee Norwegian flag. You see this a lot, the pennant, the Norwegian pennant. There's something almost medieval about it. I like it. A knight should be carrying that.
Yes, and you can also see on the cabins in the mountains.
Uh-huh.
They often have this.
Yeah. Mm. Hello. Hey. Hi, how you doing? Hey, this is pretty spiffy. I like this.
Hey.
Hello.
Hey.
How are you? I'm Mark.
Good morning.
Nice to meet you. Good morning. This is nice.
Yeah.
You got the fire on. Too hot now. This is lovely. It's all wood lined. And it's got a wee kitchen and a couple of waffle makers and power. You got water here too?
We got water and we got coffee.
Oh,
and waffles.
And waffles.
Oh.
I like you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mmm. I like this. I like this brown cheese. Most unusual. Mmm. Tasty.
So every year it's about Oh, more than 7,000 people visiting here.
Yeah. Mm. You told me earlier that somebody broke in here last summer.
Yeah.
Now, one of the arguments against, you know, us having the kind of huts that you've got in Norway is the fact, oh, they'd be broken into, it'd be vandalised. There's always an assumption that it doesn't happen here in Norway, but it does. But it's still pretty rare.
It's the first time in my 10 years in this organisation that I have been experienced this, so it's not often. And, you know, it's not big business to steal brown cheese.
So that's got to be the quote of the week. It's not big business to steal brown cheese. And the lake is just down the other side of the trees now.
Yeah, you see the lake up there? It's ice on it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We'll go down and have a look at that later.
Here you can also borrow the canoes and boat, and you can paddle, and you can swim, and you can fish.
Well, you could do all of those things if
all
it wasn't covered in ice
yeah,
at the moment.
Exactly.
And it's slightly problematic.
And it's for free.
Yeah. This is lovely because it's essentially this wee lake, or loch, is surrounded by hills. There's trees surrounding all about it. And just the tops of the trees off to the north there are painted in sunlight because it's coming across a ridge just to the south of us, through these birch trees, across through these conifers, and then it's just golden right across the top of all this dark, and you can see where it gets the name, the sort of dark lake from.
Yes, exactly. Dark lake.
Tour guide Nina Pettersson there. Those crampons, have you tried your mini crampons yet?
I'm pleased to see you still wear them to work, which is...
Oh, people, all these carpet tiles stuck to them.
People often say, why, oh, why do you do out of doors in the car park outside the Beech Grove in Aberdeen? And that's the reason, because you wear crampons and we're not allowed on the varnished floors. But yes, I have been out. I've been aerating the garden.
Yes.
What a mess. We had badgers through the other day, and I made a bigger mess than they did.
You can't have done.
Yeah, they were digging up worms big time, and I was idly kicking... I got carried away because the ground was sodden. I'm like, oh, I'll just kick this.
I was looking at a badger set this morning, funnily enough, and you could have parked a car on it. It was enormous. Anyway, Ewan parted company from Claire and myself, Claire, our producer, whilst in Norway. Now, Claire and I flew from Trondheim to Oslo. Ewan headed to Stavanger in the southwest of the country. He also had a go at Hutta culture with local tour guide Preben Falke, though in rather different circumstances.
We're at Fjørløy. Here's an old military fortress, initially built by the Germans during the World War. But nowadays we hope to make it into an outdoors activity centre, base camp for all sorts of activities out here.
Because it is magnificent. We're looking down across the fjord. You've got an absolutely idyllic lighthouse with a little white... was that a monastery you were saying?
Yeah, further inland there's an old monastery. The lighthouse is obviously a lighthouse.
Yeah, and it's quite a commanding position for the seas coming into Stavanger.
Absolutely. This is where all traffic into Stavanger will come by.
So this is a perfect spot.
For a military fortress, it was obviously, yes.
And so the Germans left, the military took it over, and now you've got it. It's quite an exciting prospect.
It is, and I think the combination of the old monastery on the other side of the island, the military fortress there, the fjords, you can climb here, you can kayak, there's good places for diving.
So can we get into this gun?
Yeah, I got a key, let's see if it works.
Great. Cannon number two. And this is big reinforced concrete, and a big, huge steel iron door. And it is just idyllic. It's almost like a golf course with gun emplacements on it.
That went well.
Yeah. Wow. You've even got helmets still on. An ammunition locker.
There's a group of volunteers, enthusiasts, that have repainted and put back their original equipment and helmets and everything here.
Wow. I haven't even got the gun. Sorry, I'm getting excited about that. But yeah, you've still got the ammunition lockers, you've still got the headsets. It's just like a step back in time. And all the wheels, and it still moves.
It still moves. I'm not sure if it's in working order, but anyway, it's as it used to be. And this is not from the war. This is built by the Norwegian military in the years following the war.
Okay, you've even got some empty gun cartridges there. Brilliant. Very different destination for walkers.
It is. I think the concept here is that a school class or groups coming in, everything can experience this part of the history and at the same time enjoy the outdoors and the nature around here.
So your plans to let people sleep? We're in the dormitory now. You've got one.
Yeah, there are some bunks there. I don't know if anyone has slept there yet, but it's obviously possible.
It's got potential, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes.
As long as you like each other. And then come back into the fresh air, and we're going to head up to one of the huts. So how extensive is your hutting network at the moment?
Well, we as a local organisation, we have 44 different lodges and huts. In Norway in total, there are more than 500. So there's really a network covering all of Norway. You can go from the southernmost tip to the north, staying at these huts throughout the mountains.
Now, this is a special one because it's kind of one-off on its own. But you've got a whole network of them up the fjords that you're going to make into one big walk.
That's true. We've got this network. Most of the cabins are in the mountains. Some of them are connected to the fjords. And we're having, in our region, the big thing is to go and visit these attractions of Preikestolen and Kjærag.
Well, for those that don't know, tell me what they are.
Two cliffs, mountain formation. Preikestolen is a very square kind of pulpit rock sticking out over the Lysefjord, 600 metres high.
This is the one that anybody seeing Norwegian tourism leaflets will have seen.
If you've seen one picture from Norway, you've seen that one, that's true. Kjærag, that's one big boulder which is stuck in a crevasse 1,000 metres above the Lysefjord. It's the same fjord, but they're further in and other side of the fjord. And you can hike up there, and you can step into the boulder if you dare to. That's the challenge for many people around here.
So you have a network of huts. How long would that walk take?
Depends on how fit you are. Some people can do it in 4 days. I would recommend if you spend a week, you have a lot of time and you don't have to do those very long hikes.
And truly spectacular. I suppose you could. The trouble is you're kind of spoiled for choice.
Oh, that's true. With those two big attractions in one fjord, and I'd like to add a third one. We got the Flørli steps, which is a wooden step going all the way from the fjord, 700 meters up. So it's 4,444 steps. So that's a challenge which you can include in a hike around the fjord.
We've just come over the top of the hill where the observation post is, and we have just got the most stunning views of Stavanger. There's islands everywhere, there's ferries crisscrossing. It's just idyllic. And I don't know much about huts, but this must be one of the... I imagine them all spectacular, but this is such a brilliant view, isn't it?
It really is. And this is built by the Germans in 1943. You're stepping on the number. And there's even a swastika here somewhere.
And we go inside and there's a lovely stove. As you say, it's still in the process of being restored. So how does this work? Do people just turn up and hope they get it to themselves?
Well, this is a special one. This you need a book, and it will open this summer. You have to book it, you get a key. But the basic principle of our cabins is that you basically show up, pay for your food, put the money in a box before you leave.
So how much would it cost to rent something like this?
This will be a one-off. You pay a standard price, I would guess, somewhere in the range between 500 and 800 kroners per night. We have a few of those small rental cabins. The open cabins in the mountains, they cost nowadays 220 for members per night.
But you got your own little special piece of history as well.
This is a really special place with the views, as you mentioned, and with access to the fjord and the history of this this fort as well.
So hopefully by the summer people will be able to rent it.
It looks like we're in good progress, so we should be able to rent this for this summer, yes.
Not many huts with their own gun emplacement. You're going to be safe anyway.
You should, yeah, that's true.
Preben Falka there, and that was a gun.
That was fantastic. There's a video of that. We'll stick it up on the Facebook page. But it was just when we went round, and I wasn't sure what I was expecting. Mm-hmm. And we come round the corner, and there's this massive gun. And then he gets his keys out, and he opens up, and he's going... And you go inside, and it's just like being in a Second World War film. Yeah. And all the bunks are there, and there's the cannon commander's bunk. It's great. What a great idea.
What a great job.
Magic.
You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland, the programme that will probably never really grow up. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElroy, and this is a special edition of the programme recorded in Norway.
Yeah, our phone lines are closed today, but you can still email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, tweet @BBCOutofDoors, or Facebook us. Is Facebook us? Or you can contact us on Facebook.
Is that available?
I don't know. Facebook. It must be. And we'll respond to some of your points when we're live on air again. I Facebook, you Facebook.
We Facebook. The temperatures, as I said before, were pretty low when we were in Norway. On average, it was about minus 15, minus 16. But I thought, listen, they're used to it. They're bound to be going out in these conditions all the time. So what's the problem going out sea kayaking in Oslo Harbour? Well, Jostein Langskjelt was my guide.
We normally not go kayaking when it's this cold, but since you're so friendly asked from Scotland, we just had to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
We asked for a double kayak for obvious reasons. I've never seen one like this before. What you've got here is essentially an open double kayak. I've never seen one.
Yeah, it's an open double kayak. It's pretty short, so it's easy to maneuver. Yeah, so it's more or less like an open canoe, actually.
Yeah.
It will suit for us, don't you think?
I think so.
Yeah?
I think so.
Yeah?
The day-to-day, I don't know what it is, maybe minus 15, something like that?
It's close to.
Yeah, minus 15, but it's a sunny day. The water, incredibly, is warmer than the air, which means that the sun is shining through all this mist. It's just skeins of mist coming off the surface of the water. It's really pretty.
It's not often you see it like this, actually. And you have a great view here, you see? You see the islands?
Yeah.
You can see the mountains up there, you know, where you can go skiing and you see over there. Uh-huh. You see the jumping hill.
Right, shall we put this in the water? So I'm slightly confused because I'm standing in front of you, facing you. I'm just looking at this paddle.
Yeah?
Is that back to front? Is that feathered back to front? The blades seem twisted the wrong way to me.
This is the right way.
Uh-huh.
Yeah? This way, if you see it this way, it's twisted the other way than you're used to.
Okay, yep.
That's how we do it over here. We drive on the roadside of the road and we twist the paddle the wrong way.
Well, that was surprisingly straightforward.
That was not bad.
Yeah.
You have done this before, I can see.
Yeah. But then again, I've fallen out lots of times before too. We'll try not to do that today.
Yeah, we'll try to skip that part today.
Okay. Let's skip it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite stable.
I suppose it's stable.
Yeah, it's not bad at all.
Almost like a canoe. Okay, should we...
Off you go.
Go for a small paddle?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good. Over, right in front of you, you have a ferry that is going to Denmark.
Uh-huh.
It's leaving pretty soon.
I can't tell you how pretty this is, actually.
Now you see you have a beautiful view over the cross-country area up in the... What they in Norwegian call Marka.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how many hundred kilometers of ski tracks you have over there, but it's a lot.
Yeah. You know, across in Scotland, the tendency for sea kayaking is to take place, you know, in remote areas. It's to be in the countryside. It's, you know, on the west coast, that kind of thing, or on the east coast, under sea cliffs, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
The idea of doing it in a city, you know, in amongst a harbour, actually works remarkably well.
Yeah, it does, it does. I think you in Scotland have more like you say, you paddle in big currents, waves, rock hopping, that kind of style.
It's maybe silly stuff.
A little bit more advanced kayaking for a little bit higher level, maybe. But this recreational paddling in Norway has actually grown really big the last year. People realise it's a beautiful way of training.
It's actually
a really good combination of training and recreation. You get to experience the nature while it's good for you at the same time.
So. The jetty just beside us has got little, almost like glass beads of ice all along the bottom of it, because it more or less comes down to the water surface. This mist is just blowing straight in our faces now, and you have the sun catching it every so often, so it's really pretty. It's like a series of veils crossing. That's very pretty. But as you see, the water is obviously very close to freezing. You know, there's seawater. It's moving differently. You can see it moving differently. It's sluggish.
Yeah, you can see it's a lot of like current. It looks like current. I don't know the exact reason, but it's some chemical reaction with the molecules.
Uh-huh.
Yeah? Yeah, that happens right before salt water freezes. So if it weren't windy now, like it is today, it would be ice here.
I think it's fantastic, this, because this entire landscape is, it's mountains, hundreds, thousands of islands up and down this coast. It basically, it's a sea kayaker's dream, this.
It's a sea kayaker's dream for paddling on a tour, on a tracking tour, to maybe sleep in tent or just to camp and relax. It's not a very, very wavy, bumpy area. If that's what you want to seek, then you have to go more over to the west coast and the open areas. Then you have to go an hour and a two paddle from here. Then you have come out in the area that opens up over to Denmark, for example. So if you are the guy looking for extreme sport or stuff like that, you can get that there.
Is sea kayaking a growing sport in Norway?
Definitely. I think the Norwegian Kayak Association, they have 17,000 or something members. That's those who are organized in some kind of club, and then you have all the other ones as well. All over the coast, people have bought kayaks to have on their cabining, paddling on the summer. We also see it in the clubs in the area that more and more people want to just be a member and use a kayak from the club. It's normal that the clubs offer a boat that you sort of, yeah, you buy a membership there and you can use it for a certain time every day or if you make some kind of booking or something. Yeah. So yeah, definitely it's growing, absolutely.
Well, if you get these, I mean, I know you don't come out normally in these kind of conditions, but to my mind, this is one of the most beautiful episodes of sea kayaking I've ever had. It's something magical about it. And just out of the mist there, four cormorants came flying.
Yeah.
It's a good
now
omen.
You can see the speed of the fog here, or the frost. It's going fast. Yeah, I agree with you. It's really beautiful on the water today. I haven't been so much in these conditions myself, but I did some years ago, and what's amazing with paddling this time of year is that you are all on your own.
Yeah.
In the summer you have boats and stuff here, motorboats, and it's not the exact same experience. The wildlife experience is better now, actually.
Sea kayaking guide Justin Lanschlett there. And there's actually, if I say so myself, there's a really nice wee video of that paddle round Oslo Harbour on our Facebook page. That was me, funnily enough.
It was a little cold, though, because I remember we went to Iceland, Greenland, many, many years ago, yeah. And you refused to go kayaking because it was going to be cold on your body.
That is a black lie. I was desperate to go on a Greenlandic sea kayak, and they wouldn't let us in because they said, if you go in the water, you're dead. Minor point, as far as you were concerned, at the time you were producing, as I recall.
We're going to stick to facts. We're going to go nowhere here.
Tell you, that waterfront development at Oslo, though, what a fantastic setup they've got. I mean, it's not just the flats and things and all the, you know, the normal appurtenances you get, but everything is shelved down into the water. You know, and what made me really laugh was because there was pancake ice at the side. There was a diving board. Ooh. If you fancy going beyond the pancake ice into the water.
To spring you out.
Yeah.
Dying. And did you do that? Because you're so keen to get into the cold water.
Just desperate to get in the cold
water. They held you back again.
They held me back, and sadly I ran out of time. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. If you miss any of this, and why would you, there are two ways of hearing it again.
Now, the first one, you can go to the BBC Radio Scotland website and look for Out of Doors, and this episode, you'll be there for the next month.
Option two, download the free weekly Scotland Outdoors podcast, enjoyed by discerning listeners across the planet, and available from the BBC Radio Scotland website every Saturday from noon. Now, a chap called Konrad Eiferth emailed us this week from Germany. He says, as an illustrator based in Berlin, I hugely enjoy listening regularly to your podcast while working. Your stories are good to make one lust for outdoor experience in Scotland, which I have visited previously. Though I am living in Berlin, we have all kinds of neighbours, like ravens, foxes and wild hogs, as it seems you do in Aberdeen. We may have misrepresented things slightly
we
there,
We do
Conrad.
Have wild hogs in Scotland, I'm not sure.
Not in Aberdeen.
Not in Aberdeen. Well, we don't know. That'll be our next task to discover that. Anyway, we love hearing from where you listen, what you're listening to, what inspires you. You'll get in touch and tell us which aspects of outdoors or life in Scotland you actually enjoy, and you know, we'll try and satisfy that demand. You can email us your stories, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
Whilst over in Norway, our producer Claire White got the mini crampons on too. They were almost de rigueur as far as I could see, and climbed a rather distinctive hill near the city of Stjenka with local walking enthusiast Asbjørn Matheson.
We are just outside the city of Stjenka. It's a very nice place, and it takes about 35 minutes to walk up here on the ice, and very soon we reach the very top, and that is the salary for coming up here. It's so nice view here.
The reward is immense. We're just mounting the crest of the hill now, and a hut at the top, and the vista is opening up as I trudge through the ice here to 360 degree James Bond style panorama all around. But right in the middle of it, I can see straight ahead of us.
Yes.
Probably the world's largest deck chair, I think, Asbjørn. What is this doing here?
Yes, we placed it here. We need an attraction here. And so many people are coming to photo it and to see the world's biggest garden chair.
Why did you choose this as an attraction?
Well, that was an idea. And I saw one in Washington that was 3 meters high, and that one's 5.
How long has it been here?
It has been for 3 years, so it's quite new.
And have you found it's attracted lots of people?
They doubled the visits up here when this chair came. That's very amazing.
The incongruous chair aside, the view is spectacular.
So this is very characteristic of the Norwegian. We see the fjords, the mountains, and we see a small city town where people live and have it happy. And it's very nice weather, and it's surroundings by also the hills. So I think it's a very nice view. Well, we are, 1,220 kilometers north of Trondheim and 90 kilometers north of Værnes Airport. On east, it's 50, 60 kilometers to the border of Sweden. It's a good place.
In the mountain, I understand, in the distance, are part of the world's largest national park?
Yeah, that's right. That is east of here. That is correct. That is a big, very big and quite new national park here. One of the biggest in Norway, that's correct.
I was so impressed on the hike up here at the speed at which you ascended. You were striding out ahead of me. If it's not rude to ask, would you mind divulging to listeners what age you are?
Well, I'm 73.
And how often do you do this hike?
I try to have a goal, my aim of 100 per year.
Twice a week you're up here?
About twice a week.
How many metres tall is this?
That is not that big. It's 330 metres up here. So it's okay. It's quite steep. So it's a good exercise, actually.
Is this part of a broader Norwegian culture, or is it just your personal passion?
No, I think it's a part of the broader culture in Norway. Walking in the forest, and therefore people want access to the forest all over. Independent of who are the owner of the land, the people want to go in the forest. And we have visitors, about 100,000 people up here every year.
Even on the path up here, there are people running, yes. People walking dogs, yeah. People of all shapes and sizes.
Yeah, that's right.
And I just can't imagine seeing the same thing in Scotland regularly.
Really? No, but it's very little people today, but quite often very, very many people are coming.
It's quite cold today, isn't it?
Yeah, it's quite cold.
Minus 12.
We go inside now.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so you're taking me into the hut on top the hill here. Oh, if only this were at the top of all our Scottish hills, we'd be thrilled.
We're going here.
It's a seriously big Norwegian cabin. And how often is this open to the public?
It's only Sundays.
Ah,
it's run by volunteers. I think we can go up further up. Oh, it's a,
oh, wow.
It's a car coming.
Okay. Talking of maintenance, yeah.
Yeah, we are working very hard to get water here because we have to drive water up from town. But now we have been drilling for water 160 meters down. There we found water. I wonder if there's a plant bear coming now.
Now, as luck would have it, Asbjørn, we've arrived at a very historic moment for this hütte.
That's correct. It's very historic. Just in this moment, the water came up from the drilling hole.
Now, you've got a cup of it in your hand, yes. And you're about to taste it for the first time.
Yes, very first one, first time to taste the water. Very good. Very, very good.
And most importantly, it will save you lots of money in running this place.
That's right. It has cost a lot to get the water, but still, we need very good.
So the hütte is no longer so basic after all.
Right, exactly. That's very good. Very, very good.
Do you say skål?
Skål. Skål in the Ofnåsen water. Very good.
I saw the light in your eyes as the water supply went in. What does this place mean to you?
That means a lot. Of course it means a lot. I used to be the municipal chief executive. And when I retired, I thought, what shall I do for volunteer work? And this is the best for people's health. And so this is very meaningful volunteer work for me.
And will this be a big, important place for most families' lives here?
Yeah, in a way, I would say so. You can see, especially nowadays, where there's no skiing. The people use this for walking. And I think it's very important. But please be careful. No falling of BBC reporters.
I think it's time to switch off the recording device and concentrate on what our feet
exactly.
are doing.
Asbjørn Matheson there, leaving Clare trailing, pecking in his wake.
Yeah, but to be fair, I mean, he sounded super fit. He's like one of these guys or women that you regularly meet in outdoors that run up Benachie 50 times a year, or the guys that do the West Highland Way in an hour and a half. and we do it every Sunday afternoon. Yeah. Hats off to them. Yeah. It just makes you feel It should make you feel inspired, but it just makes you feel a wee bit inadequate.
Yes, yes. I'm more comfortable with fellow peckers, I have to say.
Well, we have been accused in the past of actually dubbing on the pecking. Somebody got in touch and said, why do you and Mark always pretend to be out of breath when you get to the top of the hill? There's a reason for that.
Why did he think we got to the top of the hill? That's what I didn't understand. You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. This is Radio We Can Please Ourselves. And this is a special edition of the programme recorded in Norway.
Yeah, the phone lines are closed today, but you can still email us, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. You can tweet at BBC Out of Doors or Facebook us, and we'll respond to some of your points, or all your points, and we're live on air. We've got a whole team of experts dedicated to getting back in touch.
We drove past hundreds of farms in Norway. We went to visit maybe a dozen farms in Norway while we were there. We didn't see one single animal. The whole thing might be a big con, you don't know. We didn't see a cow, pig, sheep, chicken, nothing. Can't leave them outside at this time of year because they'd be flash frozen. So when Claire and I heard the yelps of dogs near a hutte just outside Oslo, I could have howled with joy myself. Sebastian Barra runs husky dog sled rides for visitors and very kindly let me have a go.
As you see, it's not so much snow today, but we can use a small trolley like this. It's a four-wheel...
It's like a quad without the engine, basically.
Yeah, actually, yes. It's really important that it's without the engine.
Uh-huh.
I like it because it's a better communication with the dogs and also because... You know, we're in the forest and we should not drive anything motorized, so I think it's very good.
Yeah. So, unusually, you've actually got the steering column on the back of the quad, and you've got a standing platform here, a bit like Ben-Hur, the charioteer. You've got the four wheels, and it's got suspension, yeah. Which is a good thing. I like suspension.
Yes, and you would be sitting on it, and believe me, it's really comfortable.
Yes.
You could even take a glass of water, you won't spill it.
Mm. You might freeze it, but you won't spill it. And what kind of dogs do you use?
I have Alaskan Huskies.
Okay.
9, actually, at the moment. So, but today we will take 5. I think it would be enough.
Yeah,
it's a
you
bit slippery, so...
We're both big guys.
I will tell you something. We just come from Svalbard.
Mm-hmm.
And all the dogs that have been born and they live there for many, many years. So it's the first time they see trees. So we have been training a little bit to avoid trees. So
Miss the tree.
Yeah, it has never been always a successful trip, but we all learn. When they see the harnesses, they just get crazy.
Yeah.
Because pulling is their thing.
That's
it's
what they do.
It's down into the genes. It's
yeah, they
amazing.
Just want to run. Yeah.
Yeah. And now it's cold temperature, so they're even more eager to to run.
Yeah.
Right. The buggy is in place.
Okay.
We'll go to the dogyard and meet the guys. They have been trained to be quite silent. It is good because we have a lot of guests when we open the cafe, so it's good that they keep quiet. So we just finished to build the dogyard yesterday.
Perfect timing then.
So, yeah, it's perfect timing.
Perfect
actually.
Timing, yeah.
Still some doghouse is missing, but yeah, you see, they're pleased to be here.
They're very keen, very keen. Pick me.
Unfortunately, we just took some of them.
Yeah.
So we'll see who are the lucky guys.
Okay.
But the leader dog we need to take.
Yeah. Who's the leader?
Rema.
Uh-huh.
That's a nice old lady over there.
Okay.
And she will be running in the lead together with a big white polar dog called Fram.
How did you get into this in the first place, Sebastian?
I was always attracted to polar dogs.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, life is such at, as I was studying and then I moved to Svalbard and then suddenly it was the perfect time to get a dog. And I started with 2 Greenland dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And then I get bitten by
Not
dog
literally
driving.
Bitten, yes, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Who else are you going to take?
I have the crazy ones and I have the calm one. I think I will go this way.
Okay.
Little girl.
Okay. I think we're ready. So if I just sit in? Okay. So that's me sitting in the front of the buggy. And Sebastian's climbing on the back, as a la Ben-Hur, as I was saying. And Gunn, Sebastian's partner, is just sorting out the dogs at the front. That's them organised. Quick release chain slipped. Saying pull and off they go. See ya. It's just a wee bit slippery there. We were kind of skidding round there.
That's pretty fun, I think.
Yeah.
We'll see afterwards how it goes.
So what has started out as a private passion is now becoming a business.
Yeah. I think we want to keep it on a very low level, like a family business. We don't want to be too big with a lot of dogs, but I think we keep the number of dogs low. But still, we want to share the joy of driving dogs with our guest, Fuji. I'm talking to the dogs, giving the instructions to turn.
G is right, Ho is left.
That's correct.
Yeah. And O for is the default position for me. They're just lovely animals. You know, they're not what people would regard as classic huskies. You know, people have a very clear idea of what they look like.
Yeah, because Alaskan Husky are not like a pure breed.
Ah.
It's a mix of polar dogs with like running dogs or hunting dogs. And the idea is to get good fur, strong paws,
yeah,
and still have the capability to run long distances.
Yeah. And there we have it.
Goha. I think I should have taken one more dog.
He's exhausted. No, I did say. I told you. It's all right. I can take a subtle hint. I'll get off. It's very good exercise for you.
Yeah, actually it is.
It's snowing gently at the moment. It is very, very cold. But it's such a beautiful way to see the countryside. It's fantastic.
I totally agree with you. And for us, it doesn't matter if it's daylight or night. We love to go out anytime.
Yeah. Dog sled driver Sebastian Barrow there.
Sounds like fun.
It actually wasn't bad at all. I tell you what did happen, almost while we were en route to find it, and it was a devil of a job to find. It was like, you know, go on the left-hand side of the, you know, go on the right-hand side. We get to the bottom of this road, and I'm going, I mean, this is like a bog-standard hire car, right? Not even a pretend 4x4. It's a bog-standard hire car. I don't even go snow tires on it. And I'm looking at the slope, and I'm thinking, I don't think we've got a hope in hell of getting up there. But we just crept up generally. We get to the top. En route, we see this guy fishing through a hole in the ice. Well, Claire fixes on it like a collie dog with a sheep and goes, we must get him.
So you stopped? After
No. There was absolutely no way I was stopping on the way going up the hill. On the way back down, we're driving out, because I mean, the guy's gone from the hole in the ice by this stage, so she's heartbroken. You know, so we've lost the ice hole fisherman.
It's all your fault.
Exactly. So we're driving out onto the main road. Lo and behold, there's a guy that looks vaguely like him from the back. Eventually, I had to turn around a mile down the road, come back. Was it the same guy? No.
Excuse me, are you an ice hole fisherman? I remember you doing that in Greenland.
And the fish were coming out fresh frozen.
Well, that's how Captain Birdseye invented the whole flash freezing process in northern Canada. He discovered when the fish were coming out, they actually tasted better when they were fresh.
Yeah, well, they were very fresh coming out of Greenland, that's for sure. Because, I mean, quite literally, you could hit them against a plank of wood and it sounded like another plank of wood. Anyway.
A fishy's island.
What we need is a cod,
two haddocks.
A ling and a seath.
And then
we'll be able to play all sorts of tunes. I don't see why not. Now, I've worked with Ewan for many a long year. Hand on heart, I have never, ever seen him look so terrified than he looked in Norway. I mean, we came back, I can't remember what we were recording there. We came back, we met you in the middle of the town, and you were grey and still shaking. He was plumbing new depths of terror. Thankfully, arguably, he was in safe hands.
We are right now at a place called Tromsdalen.
And yourself?
My name is Einar.
And we've got quite a small hole in the ground in front of us.
Yeah. This is the place that most people get skeptical when they see the cave.
Yeah, I'm one of them.
It's quite steep at the start here, so a lot of people tend to fear going down for the first time, but it's as long as you follow what we do and where we put our hands and feet, everything should be fine.
It's about mastering your fears, expanding your boundaries. A lot of this trip going through is about motivation, keep calm. But there have been grown men and women that have gone through that have cried afterwards because they have done it.
Might be crying before I've done it. Well, we're now just climbing into a hole which is about 3 feet wide, absolutely no more. And already you can feel this blast of warm air coming up as Einat's way below me. I can see the light well below. But this is a bad time to remember that you've got serious claustrophobia.
At this stage, I'll have to come clean and say, on the way up here, I lost my head torch, so you're doing it in the dark.
Yeah.
Because I've shamelessly taken yours.
That's okay. I've done it in the dark before. But if you put the light on the wall here, you see how the water has shaped the stone in the mountain.
It's completely eroded it, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, when you said this, I had quite a nice image of Santa and his grotto. I hadn't realised it was a serious cave.
It's a cave. Further down, we're coming to the cathedral. It stands up to its name.
We shall look forward to that. And a bit of space, presumably.
Yeah, it's after the rappel.
I don't even like the sound of that. Lead on. Okay, so where are we now? What's happening?
Now we're preparing for the rappel. We're going to rappel 8 metres down.
This is abseiling. It's going to get quite tight from here on in, is it?
Yeah, you'll feel it more tight. But how did you like it so far?
Terrified.
That doesn't show on you.
I sniff when I'm nervous, so you'll hear me sniffing. Let's go and do it then.
And then you'll have to sing a hymn.
A hymn, okay. I'll sing anything at this point. Okay, what's happening now is the guys are going ahead. I'm going to get roped up, and basically we're going to be free abseiling down this tiny pipe deep in the mountain. And this is a point of no return, yeah?
Yeah, this is the point of no return, because it's hard getting up here.
You're shaking.
You noticed? Yes, yeah, yeah. I am shaking. I'll come clean, I'm nervous. So what are we going to sing?
I can sing the hymn of Verdal.
Yeah.
Verdal, du ligger her med Norge sitt sterke, dyraste hjarta blod drøypt I din barm. Stiklesta lyfter et strålande merke, boren av Herrens allmektige arm.
You know, I've done some bizarre things, but this is right up there with them. Okay, and now we've got what looks like a slit in an envelope ahead of us.
Yeah, beyond this point it gets a bit narrower.
But you shouldn't have any problems.
And one of them is called the rebirth.
Excellent.
We're going to turn off our flashlights, our headlights, so we can't see anything.
Right, that light is off. I can sense a bit of growing panic. You talk about hand in front of your face. My hand is right in front of my face now, and I can not see a thing. Okay. So we go down? Down or up?
If you come here, over here.
Over the top. Am I better going up the Oh, goodness me.
Just a matter of...
A real sense.
Seconds.
Rising panic. Oh, I thought I'd be able to do this. See, it's just when you get your... You feel you're absolutely wedged in the rock. Ah. What's happened now is, as you can tell by my voice, I was panicking in there, wasn't I?
Your breath become really hyperventilating, and when you start to lose breath and panic, you really can't think straight, and you can't solve the problems inside a cave. But it's not your fault, because all humans react differently to different environments.
We're kind of wedged in there, solidly.
Yeah. I can see that your pants really have taken a beating and they're ruined, unfortunately.
Okay.
What probably will happen now, he'll go around and we'll help you up here.
Okay.
And he'll help you up and I'll go out that way.
Right, okay. Now we calm down. Oh, just got daylight above us, just coming out. Ice and snow everywhere and it's a wonderful sight. Feeling a bit of a failure there.
What?
Feeling a bit of a failure there. We got quite well down the tunnel.
Yeah, we're halfway.
Yeah.
And we had the most tight spots left, so we...
So it wouldn't have got any better?
No. And as Einar said, it was rather slippery and icy further down.
Because what happened is, well, I bottled it,
can you go any further? So you left us down there, you went right round, back up to the top, back down again, and dropped us a rope down into the cavern.
Yeah, because we didn't think we needed the rope anymore. We had already taken up the equipment. So I needed to go around so we can take it down again so we could get you up.
It's quite a climb to get out though, isn't it?
Yeah. It's really hard to do this cave this way or the other way because both has its different challenges.
Well, anyway, I'm sorry I didn't quite make it, but a great sensation and thank you very much both.
No problem.
No problem.
Staying and Ina there, out in the fresh air again. I mean, God love you, I wouldn't have touched it with a barge pole.
To be perfectly honest, I don't think you would have got in it.
No.
And that's no insult, but goodness me, that first breath, the fresh air out in the open was probably the sweetest one I'll ever... I'm still getting flashbacks about it. I'm not going to kid you.
Quite seriously, you are.
Yeah, I'm still getting flashbacks. I've got two broken ribs. And, yeah, that was quite an experience. I was very glad to have survived. But it was that in the cavern. Uh-huh. I think, I can't go back because the ropes come down. Mm. I cannot go through that hole. Yep. Without goodness knows doing what. And yeah, he went round the top and back in again as we sat in the dark and the flickering light and goodness me, that was quite an experience.
A couple of weeks after that, we were at a social event and we met this wee Italian guy, Lombardo, who looked like a sort of silent movie star, one of these little pencil moustaches. And it turns out, lo and behold, he was a caver.
Yeah.
You know, and he's saying, you get stuck all the time. He said, get stuck. I said, how long have you been stuck for? He says, longest, about 15 minutes. I'd be in a rubber room. It horrified me.
I was
stuck, I suppose, for about 15 seconds because it was that bit. Mm. Basically, I had to go down, breathe out, shuttle to the left a centimetre, breathe out again, shuttle again. And this time I was getting cramped in my leg, so I was going up.
Why would you do this?
So I was wedged in there, absolutely solid, and you could hear that piece of breathing getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and I was genuinely running sweat. Yeah. And I pulled myself out when my leg got stuck, and there was no way I was going back in to get it. So I know I'm whinging now, but not only the ribs, I've got a really sore knee, but hats off to anybody who does it. I've done caving in the past where you're kind of slithering through rocks, but when you get to the stage, you've got to breathe out to get through the space. Yeah. Step too far for me.
No. There is actually one of the less edifying photographs up on our Facebook page is of the back of Ewan's water, or where the back of Ewan's waterproof trousers used to be. Because you came out of that hole at such a rush that you left most of it behind.
Well, it wasn't that. It was actually, because I've got a T-shirt that is ripped completely, a sweatshirt that is ripped completely, the trousers and my waterproof thing are ripped to pieces, and that was going through that narrow cavern.
And the underpants went straight into the pit.
Yes, they were. Well, thankfully intact.
Oh, dear. Listen, moving on swiftly. No out-of-doors road trip would be complete without one group activity. When we visited Norway, we had to do a communal hütte walk. I'm telling you, hütte, wherever you looked. So Claire, Ewan and I donned our best long johns for a bracing family experience in the company of tour guide Froda Bergingham.
Today we are going to go to a normal Sunday walk, which a lot of people do in Norway.
And heading for a... it's not a hut, it's a hütte.
Hütte.
Hütte. Yeah.
This hütte. Is a family walk.
Yeah, this is family walk. It's a tradition in Norway, this walks on Sundays. We take our families with us, the kids.
Because we've been here quite a few days, and this is the first time we've all done something together. And Claire's joining us.
Yes, indeed.
On
most
the walk.
Unusual. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Do you think we can get along for a whole 3 kilometres?
No.
Probably not. So if this is a family walk, or I'll be dad, you can be the wean, and this can be our faithful family dog.
Yeah, he's got the ears for that.
Achoo.
He's got the deputy dog hat on, so that's fine, right? Okay, so just up here.
Yeah, let's go.
Yeah.
Sometimes the kids are not so easy to get along.
Yeah.
They have the television to watch and the games to play. And therefore, if you ask them, they not always want to go to these walks. We have a very good conversation, a very good way to spend time together. So when we have reached the hut, get the waffles, maybe a little chocolate. All the kids are having very much fun. This time we ever should have a skis on.
A ski song?
Skis. Our skis on.
All right. Our skis on.
Yeah.
Oh, you're going to burst into song there.
I don't let brought me guitar.
So how long has this system of hutting been in operation? Is it relatively recent?
Tradition that goes back a long time. And tourist association started work in the middle of 19th century, in the National Romantic period. At the same time, they're adventurers discovered the North Pole and the South Pole and things like that. Because of that, it's a great part of the Norwegian culture and tradition. Of course, this is not adventure, maybe, but it's...
It's an adventure for us.
Yeah.
Adventure for Cleo.
It's still an important tradition.
We are going through the forest at a phenomenal rate.
A fair foot.
Drinking the atmosphere. No, smell the pine.
Pursuant to our policy of not doing what we're told, let's try something dangerously new and radical.
But stop.
Yeah. Because it is actually quite peaceful around about here.
It's gorgeous. Yeah. It's supposed to be a gentle family walk, unfortunately. The two fitter members of our group have romped up.
Sadly, our romping days are over. There's farmland off to our left-hand side, with juniper growing in it. We're walking up an avenue of birch trees, and the branches are just festooned in lichen. And we came round the corner there and we thought, hang on a minute, that's not the hütte.
Well, that's a mansion.
That's a mansion, but I don't think that's it. Or if it is, I'm going to be seriously impressed. Frodo, that's not the hütte, is it?
Yes, it is. It's an old farm, 18th century.
Uh-huh.
Now it's a hütte for the people who walk in the
It's
in
huge,
the woods
though. It's a mansion. London. So can people stay here?
No, it's not for overnight. It's just for visiting during the day.
And there's a bonfire going.
And there's a bonfire going. I was about to say, because it's quite a large red building. Mm-hmm. Slate roof, 10 windows, porch in the front, and this blue smoke just drifting across the front of it.
On a fine Sunday in February, there can be 1,000 persons up here on the Sunday morning or Sunday noon.
Oh, that's great.
And not one, but two bonfires.
Well, they've got a couple of concrete pipes, like drainage pipes, which they've built up, and the bonfires are built on top of that. Leftover, that would go in the car park, by the way.
Leftover Christmas trees, that's perfect for the car park.
And you've got not just leftover Christmas trees, but mats to sit on, to insulate our little bottoms.
There's nothing better than a fire on a day like this, and we're just getting the occasional fleck of snow, 1914. Just lovely.
Norwegian flag flying, Christmas trees still with lights on, and most importantly, there's a gorgeous view looking over the misty hills in the distance.
Hello, Heidi.
Hi.
Thank you.
Tusen tak.
She's the one who makes us...
Yeah.
Okay, food today.
We're absolutely fine. It's lovely.
We're just slightly distracted because we're talking to the lady from the hütte, but there are two people coming down behind her down a very icy slope carrying trays full of crockery, and it's got disaster written all over it. I have to say, this is pretty impressive.
It is.
The ubiquitous waffles, pancakes, hot chocolate, jam.
Coffee's arrived.
Cream. Coffee's arrived as well.
Excellent. Brilliant.
Oh, this is lovely, isn't it?
Lovely standing in that wood smoke, just get the scent of it.
It is great. I just keep on going back to Scotland and think, we don't really have this. Maybe you'll correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, I know some of the mountain bike centres have this, but we don't, as a rule, have places like this and it's stuck in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And as we were touching on earlier, that's got to be great in a family walk for getting children of that. Are we there yet, Dad?
Mm-hmm.
A halfway stop where you can warm up and have something to eat and have some hot chocolate.
Yeah, the fascination of fires, too. This has been a great trip, this.
It's a quintessentially Norwegian experience we're in the middle of, and that's, I think, what I've liked most about being here. If I were to pick a highlight, it was probably my hike up the hill, Uftenesen, with the lovely Asbjørn, 73 years old, and heading up that hill, 300 metres high, 100 times each year.
Mm-hmm.
He was as fit as his fiddle, as was his wife. They kindly lent me their Fair Isle-styled long johns to wear for the journey. I think the kind of sense of togetherness, the hospitality we've experienced here, the sense of living life to the max and making the most of all your natural resources is what's really struck me about this trip.
How about you? For me, it's kind of more memorable. It was the low point. It's just been down that grotto, that cave... Probably the most terrifying experience I've ever had in my life.
Yeah.
But we got out, and that sensation, that first gulp of fresh air and the Norwegian sunshine and snow, is a sensation to be savoured.
Yeah.
It is fantastic.
And that, I'm afraid, is it from the Scotland Outdoors podcast this week. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed our tales from Norway as much as we enjoyed being there. Please get in touch with us anytime at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, or, as I said before, you can visit our Facebook page. Just look for Out of Doors. Until the next time we meet up, thanks for listening.